This is KJZZ, your member-supported news and information station. I'm Catherine Fertke, and these are the stories you don't want to miss. For the week of June 5th, here are some top stories. A new report on healthcare examines the rural parts of the nation, including Arizona. Here's KJZZ's Lauren Gilger.
Republicans have to work quickly if they hope to pass their replacement for the Affordable Care Act by the end of summer. The U.S. House passed its version, the American Health Care Act, last month, and now the Senate is expected to push its own version. A concern for many in the healthcare debate is Medicaid, which would be scaled back significantly under the House plan. And a new report shows that could particularly hurt rural Arizona. KJZZ's Will Stone covers healthcare, and he joins me to explain. So, Will, Medicaid covers nearly 2 million people in Arizona. What do we know about how the program affects small towns and rural areas here?
That's right, Lauren. It has a huge impact on populations here in Arizona. We know Medicaid, what we call access here in Arizona, has a disproportionate impact on rural areas. The report from Georgetown University's Center for Children and Families found that nationally about 45% of children enrolled in Medicaid were in small towns. And in Arizona, that number's even higher. It's 54%. And that's about 18% higher than the metro areas of the state. For adults, the number's not as high, but it's still the highest. Arizona has the highest percentage of folks who are covered by Medicaid in rural areas as well. So many of those are covered by the program. They're low income, women, children, people with disabilities. But in Arizona, where we expanded the program under the Affordable Care Act, low income folks, what are referred to as childless adults, are also covered by the program.
Okay, and how would the House replacement plan, the AHCA, impact those people?
The legislation cuts the program dramatically. It's by more than $800 billion over the next decade. It would be converted from an open-ended entitlement program where the federal government kicks in money as more people join to one that's capped. So basically giving states a limited amount of money and allowing them to figure out how to make that work. The law also phases out the Medicaid expansion, which this report found has already brought down the uninsured rate in rural America. So it's likely many people could lose their coverage here or at least see it altered. And capping the program would especially hurt Arizona, some experts say, because, you know, our program is already low cost and efficient, and we have a growing high need population. I spoke with Joan Alker, who's one of the study's authors, and she says slashing the program could have a profound impact, not just on individuals' health care, but the well-being of the communities. I spoke with her via Skype.
With the level of cuts that Congress is contemplating in the repeal of the ACA, Arizona is very much at risk. And there's no way that the state could make up the difference there. They would have to move to cut provider rates or limit enrollment, depending on what tools, you know, the federal government gives them to make these cuts.
And politically, we know that rural America and Arizona went for President Trump in the election. So the question is, will the president be okay with the economic repercussions of this bill on his base?
Right. So what's next in this debate, Will? Do we have a sense of what Congress will do now?
It's been reported by NPR and others that the Senate has been secretly crafting its own health care repeal bill that it hopes to get passed before the summer recess. It's expected that they may try to make that more palatable to moderates, like Senator Jeff Flake, who, like our Governor Doug Ducey, may have concerns about how cutting Medicaid will play out in Arizona. There's also the Children's Health Insurance Program, what we call Kids Care here, and that covers children from families who don't quite qualify for Medicaid but are still up to 200% of the federal poverty line. So right now the federal government is paying all of our costs for that program. But if that level of funding goes down, our program is automatically frozen. And you'd see 20,000 children have joined it since we reauthorized it. So it could impact that as well.
All right. That's KJZZ's Will Stone. Will, thanks.
Thank you.
And now from KJZZ's The Show, news about the Frank Lloyd Wright House in Arcadia. Here's the show's Steve Goldstein.
Today marks 150 years since legendary architect Frank Lloyd Wright was born in Richland Center, Wisconsin. It's also a key date in moving closer to ending a nasty neighborhood dust-up in Phoenix's Arcadia area. The David Wright House, designed by Frank Lloyd Wright for his son and daughter-in-law, had been a relatively quiet locale for most of its existence. That changed when the house was purchased by attorney Zach Rowling, who intended to turn it into a place people could visit and learn more about Wright and his legacy. But would it become a commercial space in the quiet neighborhood and bring concerts and public events? That's what some of the nearby residents worried about, and it led to flyers and signs popping up that read "Right House, Wrong Place." That conflict dragged on for a few years, until now. Rawling is gifting the David Wright House to the School of Architecture at Taliesin, which used to be known as the Frank Lloyd Wright School of Architecture. It's the largest gift the school or the Frank Lloyd Wright Foundation has ever received. Earlier, I met with Rawling and Aaron Betsky of the school at the Wright House to find out about the gift and its impact on architecture and Wright's legacy. I started by asking Rawling why, after years of conflict, the arrangement with the school made sense now.
Well, my mom and I started the project because she wanted this to be a community space and to give people across the valley the opportunity to have the beautiful experience of seeing a Frank Lloyd Wright building, and also to be inspired, you know, to bring creativity in their own lives. And the Taliesin Fellowship is the very natural institution to realize, you know, those goals in the very highest sense. My mom studied architecture and was an elementary school teacher years before that, and had always admired the Taliesin Fellowship and that creative community that the Wrights created and really, you know, reinvigorated his work late in life. And the 50s were a period of major experimentation for him, and certainly the David Wright House is part of that era of immense creativity for a man, you know, in his 80s designing a family home for his son and daughter-in-law.
Aaron, how important is this partnership going to be to the future of Taliesin West, the architecture school?
It's transformative. It really gives the school the chance to build on the legacy of Frank Lloyd Wright and on the incredible experience we have at Taliesin, Taliesin West, of living architecture. That's our motto, live architecture. And bring it now into the middle of the valley. Through Zach and his family's generosity, we get to be part of the center of the valley, and we get to use Frank Lloyd Wright's legacy that spirals out of the existing landscape into a better future that we as students and faculty want to design for the Valley and for the world beyond. It's an incredible opportunity for us.
How many students could be here at one time? What are the possible things they can do here?
The site is absolutely remarkable, and it's going to be even more remarkable when we get done restoring it and redesigning it. We're a very small school, probably the smallest architecture school in the world. There's right now about a dozen students in our graduate program. We'll double that this fall. But we will have several faculty members and students living here, no more than four. That's kind of the maximum right now. The students will be working here. Starting this fall, they're going to be working on redesigning the site to bring back the original orange grove. The house was designed to rise up out of that orange grove. And the students will be working here. There'll be a design studio here where not all of the students, but maybe a dozen of them, will be working away. And obviously we'll also invite the community to be part of that process.
How vitally important is it to be almost enmeshed in what he actually created?
On a very immediate level, just because it's a daily inspiration, and I can point to things, I can have a student look up at the ceiling where we're sitting now and say, see, that's how you can do a ceiling. But what's very important is that we're not interested in imitating Frank Lloyd Wright. I always tell the students, don't ask what Frank Lloyd Wright did. Ask what he would do. So what we want to do is extend his notion of building with the land, not on it. His notion of breaking the box. His notion of building for an American democracy. You know, I like to say to the students, if you want to learn how to design pretty boxes, there's plenty of schools where you can learn that.
So as we know, there had been some conflict leading to this eventually. So for people who had been concerned about noise, parking, et cetera, how does this agreement affect that?
Well, I think that the concern had always been that a house museum could struggle and deteriorate into a commercial event space. And our aspirations had always been that this would be an educational and cultural and community space. And now that it will be controlled by and operated by an 85-year-old school of architecture founded by the most influential architect in American history, all of the programming will be consistent with that graduate you know, schools curriculum and the cultural and community programming will be derivative of the traditions of 85 years of at Taliesin West and Taliesin. So it takes it out of the commercial realm into a very high educational realm, which I think diminishes virtually all of the concerns.
When did you first discover Frank Lloyd Wright? When did he pique some interest for you?
I grew up a mile and a half down the canal, and my mom took me here on bicycle in second grade. So this was the building that introduced me to Frank Lloyd Wright and to architecture, and this was the start of a lifelong love that my mom and I continue to share.
Why did it affect you in such a way other than being a child? Is there something about Frank Lloyd Wright that, obviously we'll ask the architecture expert as well, but what makes him linger? What makes him so easy to connect with for so many people?
There is the beauty of the buildings, but I think more importantly, there is a sense of place and a spirit of the age. And this building and this place, I think, captures the essence of what people love about Phoenix. It's the mountain views. It's the water that you know, feeds the orange groves. It's the big sky, and it's this, you know, spiral house rising to the heavens, but made with very simple materials. And it's the idea that thoughtful design and creativity can transform how we live and how we experience nature around us.
For me, it was a slightly different experience. You know, I'm an American, but I grew up in the Netherlands. And I grew up in a sort of standard suburban home. Went off to college in America. Came back and went, darn, I never realized that the house in which I grew up and every other house in the Netherlands ultimately would not have looked that way if it hadn't been for Frank Lloyd Wright, because he had such a strong influence on Dutch architecture, beginning of the 20th century. And everywhere I've lived, you see that kind of influence in a completely different way. But I tell you, one thing that's remarkable, and it's true, and Zach talks about it with great passion as well, about this house, but it's true, every place he designed, you get there, and your first reaction is, it looks so absolutely right, exactly where it is.
Aaron Betsky of the School of Architecture at Taliesin and Zach Rawling, owner of the David Wright House in Arcadia. Today marks Frank Lloyd Wright's 150th birthday and the official announcement of Rawling gifting the house to the School of Architecture.
You're listening to the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. From the Fronteras Desk, immigrant arrests under President Donald Trump have soared since he took office, but federal records show the number of people crossing the border illegally has dropped, and that's slowly changing the face of deportees in Mexico's border cities. From the Fronteras Desk, KJZZ's Michelle Marisco reports on this new and growing group of deportees and how Mexico is handling the influx.
35-year-old Ricardo stepped off a white government deportation bus and crossed into a chaotic Nogales, Mexico on a late May night. He was disoriented and his upper body was wrapped in a black support vest. He said it was issued by a hospital in Denver after he hurt himself when he fell from a scaffold while hanging drywall. We spoke outside Mexico's immigration office at the border in a gritty white hallway with narrow steel benches bolted to the tile floors. Two doors, one leads to Mexico's side of the port of entry, the other leads into Mexico itself. A beggar chanted softly under the harsh fluorescent lights outside a border dentist office behind us. Ricardo still bore injuries to his stomach and on his right side. His story is a common one. He had crossed 10 years ago on a tourist visa, stayed illegally in the U.S. working, and sent money back to his wife in Mexico until he was injured. After he was hurt, the Ricardo said immigration agents were called and appeared at the hospital where he was detained, then bused back to Nogales and ended up here. Federal records show that apprehensions along the Mexico border are down, way down. Border Patrol charts on the number show lines plummeting and near dead vertical drops from 47,000 arrests in November to just 11,000 last April. At the same time, immigration and customs enforcement numbers have stayed much the same under President Trump as they did under former President Barack Obama. 57,000 this January to April, 66,000 in the same 4 months of last year, and 91,000 in that same time period of 2014. Taken together, those numbers are creating a new reality on Mexico's border. A changing demographic of deportees hovering on the foreign streets of a country where they were born and separated from a country they once called home. A volunteer leads 40 people through a prayer exercise at the Kino Border Initiative, a church-run kitchen for deportees and those heading north. People awaiting a hot meal giggle as the volunteer leads their chant.
My name is Sean Carroll. I'm the executive director of the Kino Border Initiative.
The shelter serves up about 46,000 meals a year. And this year, it's on pace to match that, dropping arrests at the border and though.
This year, we're serving more people who have been living in the U.S. for a number of years and then are detained and deported.
Arnulfo Hernandez stands outside the shelter. He wears a rosary over a rock T-shirt and a worn towel draped over one shoulder.
I was arguing with my wife, you know, just words, and the neighbors called the cops on me.
He lived in Ohio for 18 years. Now he lives in the Nogales, Mexico shelter. He says he'll probably return to his mother's home in Oaxaca.
Because I wanted to go back to the U.S., but not right now. I don't think it's a good idea right now.
At the Juan Bosco Migrant Shelter in the hills of the city, a drunk musician weaves back and forth, strumming his guitar and singing to the migrant men waiting inside the shelter's chapel. Juan Francisco Loredo runs the shelter. He says the number of migrants he sees has dropped, but like his Mexican federal government counterparts, he's suspicious as to why. He worries that the U.S. will deport people held in overcapacity detention centers in one massive rush, overwhelming Mexico's border cities. As for Ricardo, the injured man at the port, sheepishly he says he goes home to his small town now in southern Sonora, broke and injured, his only belongings stuffed into a clear plastic bag emblazoned with the blue Homeland Security Department logo. After that, he said he didn't want his last name used because he'll probably try to cross again. Michelle Marisco, KJZZ News, reporting from Nogales, Sonora.
In education news, here is a report on some new proposed legislation.
Arizona Senator John McCain is hoping to expand the school choice movement in Indian country. On Tuesday, he and Oklahoma Senator James Lankford introduced a bill that would give students enrolled in Bureau of Indian Education schools an education savings account that can be used for things like private school tuition. KJZZ's Carrie Young has been covering this federal school system for the last few years here at KJZZ, and she joins us now. Good morning, Carrie.
Good morning, Lauren.
So, Carrie, I understand this isn't the first time McCain has introduced legislation like this. So what's behind this effort?
Well, from what McCain is saying, it seems like this is his reaction or, I guess, proposed solution to the ongoing struggle that this school system has historically had with student performance and maintaining safe infrastructure or school buildings. We've got a bit of tape from him, actually, and he describes it this way.
The Indian schools are arguably the absolute worst of any part of our nation. And that's a shame. Because when we sent these Native Americans to these reservations, we made promises to them, water, health care, education, and other commitments we made. And obviously, we've not only failed to keep that commitment, but we've betrayed our solemn obligation to them.
Carrie, give us a little bit of background here. You've been covering this for KJZZ for a long time. When McCain says things like these schools are the worst in the nation, where's that coming from?
So, I mean, the struggles at the BIE aren't new. There have been several reports from the Government Accountability Office, for example, documenting things like unsafe school building conditions, falsified inspections, and other serious administrative issues. Student performance is also something that the school system has historically struggled with. In 2015, for example, BIE fourth graders were scoring about 22 points lower in reading and 14 points lower in math than Native American students enrolled in state public schools. Now, that being said, in 2014, the department did embark on a massive reform effort that involves restructuring how the agency works. But just like any major federal reform, that's going to take a lot of time to execute.
And Carrie, so based on the conversations you've had with tribal leaders and with parents, is school choice something that could really work, or is it something that's even wanted in these communities?
Well, that's a good question, Lauren. And the answer is there's a lot of mixed feelings about the BIE school system. And so while the BIE was born more than 100 years ago as a system that was focused on assimilation. For many tribes, BIE schools today are a place where tribal culture can play a large role in day-to-day instruction. The school that I visited for our coverage recently of the BIE reform effort, Crystal Boarding School, it was a place that community members really loved. One parent I spoke with there, Eileen Russell, who has a daughter and a granddaughter there, says her family loves the small class sizes and all of the culture classes.
They like being in there every day, because the other schools, we only had culture once a week for 40 minutes or something, but here they have it every day.
But not every BIE school is like that. It's really community specific. Take Havasupai, for example. Tribal leaders there just sued the federal government for the conditions at their BIE school and for not providing their kids in general with an adequate education. There are many days when the school is closed because of a building issue or there just aren't enough staff to man the operation. So to your question, is school choice something that could work in Indian Country? Well, we can look at Arizona, for example. BIE students are one of the groups that have been eligible for our voucher system even before it was expanded, and there have been families that took advantage of it and liked it. So if it's expanded nationwide to BIE schools, I'm sure that would still be the case. But you also still run into some of the same challenges. The bill would give parents 90% of what the federal government was spending to educate a child in a BIE school. If you live in a remote reservation, finding transportation to another school could be one major challenge. And you can also argue the same things that reducing funding to the BIE, as far as like what they have to work with for their reform effort, it's really not going to help complete that.
Right. That's KJZZ's education reporter, Carrie Young. Carrie, thanks for breaking this down for us. It's complicated.
Thanks, Lauren.
In a check of business news, operators of sober living homes delivered a message to elected officials in Phoenix. Don't regulate us out of business. From the KJZZ Business Desk, Christina Estes reports the city must balance neighborhood concerns with federal laws designed to ensure people with disabilities have equal opportunities to housing.
During a meeting Tuesday, members of a city subcommittee heard from several owners of sober living homes.
We take men that are broken and we make them whole.
I was able to go back to school, finish college, start my own business, and become a taxpaying member of society.
I have four houses through the valley. I've never had a complaint filed with the city. I've never had problems.
Please don't strangle us with too many regulations.
They're worried about city leaders changing the rules and making it harder for them. But Councilman Daniel Valenzuela said it's not about shutting down an industry. It's about getting rid of the bad operators.
There are people taking advantage here. There are people impacting negatively our neighborhoods because they are taking advantage. So if you're in the business and if you're doing a good job and you're doing it right, you have nothing to worry about.
The subcommittee approved changes to make sure Phoenix is in compliance with federal fair housing laws while still trying to keep homes at least one quarter mile apart. The full council must still approve. Christina Estes, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And finally this week in the world of science, self-driving cars, Frankenfoods, Terminator mosquitoes. Is our progress outpacing our precautions? From the Arizona Science Desk, KJZZ's Nicholas Gerbis reports.
Greetings, my friend. We are all interested in the future, for that is where you and I are going to spend the rest of our lives.
If the pace of progress ever fills you with dread, it's probably because of sentiments like this.
We need to innovate as much and as fast as possible, and if there are problems, somebody will find a solution somewhere.
That's Andrew Maynard, a risk expert at Arizona State University. There's just one problem.
We're now living in such a tightly coupled world, and by tightly coupled, I mean everything we do is connected to something somebody else does, that we can no longer afford to be so laissez-faire about the risks we take.
But as daily concerns max out our mental bandwidth, we rarely spare time for issues like risk, except when disaster strikes. ASU science and policy expert Daniel Sarowitz says that won't do.
We have to get away from that attention cycle problem where it's crisis-driven and instead build into the innovation process itself this ability to think through what we're doing as we're doing it.
For emerging technologies like synthetic biology, artificial intelligence, and gene editing, all of which experts have expressed concern about, that goes double, says ASU's Dave Gustin, also an expert in science and policy.
They're high consequence but high uncertainty.
But risk entails more than odds and outcomes. It involves values. And beyond life and limb, those can vary a lot. Consider qualities like dignity or autonomy, for example.
They're quite intangible, but these are the things that really motivate people or really crush them when they're taken away.
So understanding innovation and risk means looking beyond good and bad.
What those simple dichotomies end up missing is that change is going to happen. And the question is, to whom do the benefits flow and who are exposed to the risks?
When there are stresses on society, the people who have less economic, social, intellectual, institutional wherewithal are going to get screwed more than others.
So risk is highly subjective. Still, maybe we could agree on certain avenues of research to which we should just say no, like, I don't know, dinosaur parks?
Your scientists were so preoccupied with whether or not they could, they didn't stop to think if they should.
There is the argument that some types of knowledge we probably shouldn't have. The only difficulty is it's really, really hard to stop people discovering that knowledge.
We also struggle against our own fears to judge such questions objectively. Many of us distrust air travel despite its safety record.
People don't like seating control.
That's ASU neuroscientist Sam McClure. It's not hard to see how such fears could translate to, say, self-driving cars.
How comfortable are you going to be getting on the freeway and pressing a button and just letting the car take over?
Our mental foibles get in the way of properly gauging risk in other ways as well.
If you present things slightly differently, then you can get people to behave different ways.
Part of that involves a practice known as framing.
So you can change people's risk preferences just by the way you phrase something.
That said, we could be as rational as a Vulcan actuary, and we'd still have to overcome basic uncertainty. Coleridge's dilemma observes that the easiest time to regulate something is also when you know the least about what might happen.
In 1910, we didn't know what the risks of internal combustion engines were going to be vis-a-vis the climate, right? Now we know, well, you can't tell a billion people to stop driving.
Complexity, too, carries its own cost.
There's a theory of normal accidents that basically says in any complex system, you're always going to have some accidents. You can't get rid of them.
So what to do? Well, experts emphasize education, critical thinking, personal responsibility, and making our democratic institutions build more resilient systems.
It's not a formula. It's not like we can't say we know what the risks are going to be, and therefore we're going to pursue the technology this way and not that way. But we can keep our eyes open in a lot more determined fashion.
Will it work? Only time will tell.
And remember, my friend, future events such as these will affect you in the future.
Nicholas Gerbus, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
This has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by Vitalist Health Foundation, the IEEE Foundation, the Arizona Community Foundation, ASU Research, Alliance Bank of Arizona, Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to KJZZ and for your generous support. I'm Catherine Furtke, and this is KJZZ, your news and information source.